Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Buongiorno. It is Halloween 2021. We keep rolling. Today, we have an exciting guest. He's had a long storied career in the entertainment industry, working in film, TV, journalism. The writer and director of the incredible documentary series In Search of Darkness, a journey into iconic 80s horror, In Search of Darkness 2, as well as the upcoming In Search of Tomorrow and In Search of Darkness 3. Visit 80shorrordoc.com to get involved with that. Producer, director, journalist, and nostalgia curator, David Weiner. Welcome.
I guess that's me. How's it going, Mike? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. I love the term nostalgia curator, and I might steal it for myself.
By all means. By all means. It's a vocation that I have come up with a title for, but I'm not going to copyright it. I think everyone should be one themselves. The idea of taking the things that you know and love from the past and sharing it with the next generation, I think is something that some people are interested in doing. Some younger generations are receptive to it. Or you could be like my kid, who's like, whatever, Dad, let me play my Roblox.
Well, so you're already getting me into really interesting questions that I have for you. In Search of Darkness 2, some of the films covered in that documentary are not what you would call, like, quote unquote, good movies. Like, you have, Nightmare, that Joe Bob Briggs is making fun of. You have, The Beast Within, where you guys are kind of goofing on it. What do you think is the value of even remembering so-called bad films?
These movies, it goes back to that nostalgic curation. These movies are important to all of us for a variety of different reasons. And my approach to any of the In Search of Darkness movies is, I think we all have to have a sense of humor about these movies, but the idea is not to judge and make fun of everything. It's a time capsule of an era when the technology to make these things was different. You know, it's a practical effects era. And a lot of this stuff is works of art. And compared to any CGI you see these days, or at least in the last decade or so, arguably, you'd rather have a rubber monster right in front of you that you know is fake, but at least you know is sharing the room with an actor acting, versus a bunch of, you know, ones and zeros and from pixel pushers. So, I think the most important thing that at least I do when I approach these movies, you know, mind you, yeah, they sometimes make fun of them a little bit, is that they're all kind of on an even playing field and you can come to your own judgment about them. So, you know, if you want to talk about Chopping Mall, if you want to talk about The Beast Within, if you want to talk about The Shining, or you want to talk about, you know, a David Cronenberg film, whatever it may be, there's clearly critically acclaimed masterpieces that have become classics in their own right. And then there's movies that we love, the movies that we shouldn't have seen when we were a little too young, the movies that our friends shared with us, the movie that on that crappy day that you had from school or with family that you got to sit in front of HBO or go to the movie theater or, you know, your cousin's house and pop in a videotape on the VCR. Doesn't matter what it was, it's the memory and the happiness that came from that experience. And that's really kind of the elements that we're trying to capture with these movies.
And I think you totally achieve that. You brought up VHS, and these films are sort of visually framed in this way of almost like you're traveling through a video store. Now, kids, ask your grandparents about what video stores were. It's funny, people have nostalgia for Blockbuster now. I have nostalgia for the mom and pop stores that let me rent Carrie and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre when I was like 10, because they knew my family and I lived across the street and they really didn't give a crap. that visual sort of like wall of all of these disparate little images, we really don't have that. I mean, like, you could go on Netflix or Shudder and you can see all the little thumbnails, but it's not the same thing.
The stakes were much higher when you actually went to a video store. I think what we're talking about now is kind of an interesting thing to deconstruct a little bit, at least for a generation that didn't experience it. Because I know for a fact, everyone's like, yeah, the video store, we don't have them now. And it was such a spectacular thing. Yeah, but you know, you don't have, you know, your streaming where you could just get something what you want, you know, what you want instantly. You know, but there's always, you know, the older generation, and I think we are now very much part of that, I'll speak for myself at least. You know, we're always going on and pining for a time when you didn't have it all at once. And that's maybe a hard concept to wrap your mind around if you're younger, but there's an instant gratification society that exists now that maybe doesn't understand or appreciate why these things landed more intensely for us is because we had to wait. You know, we had to wait for it. We had to wait in line. We might, you know, if we want to see a movie, if Star Wars came out, you know, or Poltergeist, and you had to wait 2 hours in line, you couldn't reserve your seat. You couldn't get your ticket in advance. You may or may not get in while you're waiting to that show, and you'd still have to wait yet another show or two.
Yeah.
Sometimes you had to wait outside all the time. You know, if you went into the video store and you wanted a particular title, that title might not have been there. That's also the difference between Blockbuster versus mom and pop. You know, Blockbuster kind of solved that in that equation by having, you know, multiple copies of the newest release. And that's what sort of made them explode like mushrooms. But, you know, you walked in that store and if they didn't have the title that you wanted, you got other things. But it also allowed you to discover other things. So I'll finish what I thought, because I know you want to jump in, because I can see you feel the same way. But, you know, ultimately, you know, people just, you discovered other things that weren't available sometimes you discovered other movies because things that you wanted were unavailable, or you had to wait, or you had to go to several stores. And there's something all about this having, you know, all good things to those who wait. You know, you discover new things, or you appreciate that much more when you finally have whatever that thing is in your hands. And there's some merit to that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, one thing to compare, like, thumbnails on a streaming service. First of all, we've all read that, like, now Netflix will give you various thumbnails based on what they think you like. So if you've shown to, like, you know, this particular actor, they'll get, you know, they got 10 or so thumbnails for every film, that whole weird thing.
Yeah, the algorithm knows you better than your spouse knows you.
Right. Compare that to the VHS cover of Dead and Buried, which is gorgeous, but tells you nothing about the film. It dares you to figure out what it's about.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, also on the cover, it says, you know, from one of the writers from the writer of Alien, says something to that effect. You know, back then you knew Dan O'Bannon because you loved Alien, and you're thinking, wow, this must be like Alien because I love Alien and Dan O'Bannon wrote it, you know. Anyway, so clearly it's had absolutely nothing like that. But yeah, I mean, I finally got around to renting that simply because of the Dan O'Bannon and Alien on the cover and that evocative art. But I still had no idea what that was about. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching and I'm like, wait, this is more like Stephen King, New England Town, murder mystery. Oh, there's some nudity and, you know, cool effects. But it was kind of like, you know, Chopping Mall. That's my favorite example to bring up, because that art was nothing like what the movie was. That title was nothing like the movie was, you know? And it was a title that infamously changed, you know? But I avoided that one for years just based on my taste. I was just like, yeah, this nuance, you know, I've seen Dawn of the Dead. I love Dawn of the Dead. I've seen Day of the Dead. Why do I need to see Chopping Mall? I'm sure it's the same thing. They show you a bag with a bunch of body parts in it. I'm like, yeah,
right.
You know. But then I finally got around to it. I'm like, wait, this is like, you know, Johnny Five meets the Terminator at the mall. Like, okay, this is totally different.
I know. I always think of the VHS for House, which is that sort of zombie hand.
Yeah, ding dong, you're dead.
Right? I mean,
but you don't know there's comedy, right?
Right. You really kind of, or another one was, do you remember, I believe it was the second or third Sleepaway Camp had the protagonist, but on her like bag, she had Jason's machete and Freddy's.
Right. With a model that's not even the star of the film. Right.
Right. Right.
And you're like, okay. Well, I even remember with that one, I dodged that one because I during those times when those were available, I was becoming or already a cynical teen. And I was like, oh, they're clearly trying to, you know, get me to rent this because they're, you know, trying to nod to other franchises that this has nothing to do with.
Right.
And at the time I was just like, yeah, you're not going to get my, you know, 250 or whatever it may be.
Right.
So, you know, but I got around to these later. And I think part of the appeal of making these movies and curating the material for these movies is revisiting a lot of the stuff that I kind of disregarded to a certain extent when I was that age because of whatever reasons. And like I said, I was just a cynical teen. And now there are these wonderful time capsules. And whether they're the real McCoy or just clearly a knockoff movie, they're all fun to me now.
Yeah, the having a value judgment almost is, it's not what it's about. Because they're so of the sort of time that they are. And by the way, what is it, your age? What made you pick the 80s? I mean, VHS existed in the 90s, not so much in the 70s, but there was a lot of great horror films in the 70s. Why did you zone in on the 80s?
Well, it all started with Robin Block, who executive produces these. He did In Search of the Last Action Heroes, and then he wanted to do, you know, I could kind of do this for genres. I just did action. I could do this for horror. I could do this for sci-fi. I could do this for fantasy. I could do all sorts of things. But the conceit is that you choose one particular decade that, you know, is appealing to a certain audience. But there's an element of not many movies, at least up until the point that In Search of Darkness came along. There were dime a dozen movies talking about the history of horror or certain genres or subgenres of horror. But there really wasn't a movie that just said 80s, beginning to end, only the horror movies. And that was an opportunity that came to me that I just jumped at. You know, my background, part of it is, you know, I was editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. I've just been a monster kid all my life. And then when someone says, hey, you know, here's a blank canvas, talk about 80s horror movies. For me, that was when, you know, I was born in 68. So I'm a 70s kid and an 80s teen. So I'm like the equivalent of like the John Hughes, Rat Pack generation in terms of my movie going habits. And so when I was just getting old enough to really get into this stuff was really at the beginning of the 80s. And so while I was very scared, but still wanted to see The Exorcist and The Amityville Horror and The Omen. And, you know, I wanted to see Alien on the big screen, but my mom said, you'll get nightmares, you know.
Yeah.
There was that tween tens transition that I had, you know, right at the beginning of the 80s where I was like, I didn't have to battle to go see, you know, American Werewolf in London. You know, so my eyes just, that was like a revelation to me about not only can a horror movie be incredibly well-crafted in terms of its story and its humor and its pacing and just the idea, but the, you know, the practical effects were mind-blowing, you know? And so all of a sudden I was like, who did this? All right, who's this Rick Baker guy? You know?
Yeah.
I need to know how. I've always been that guy who I just show up at a movie to be entertained. But if I'm blown away, I really want to know how and why and what and what's the story behind it. How was this made? You know, how was this so effectively rocking my world? And that goes down back to, you know, John Carpenter's Halloween as well. But yeah, I was watching these movies, you know, whether it was Star Wars that blew my mind or American Werewolf that blew my mind. I was at an age where I decided I really wanted to know more than just about the story and the experience in the theater. I wanted to know how these things were made. I don't know. I think I've lost track of the question.
Me too. That's fine.
Oh, you said why the 80s? You said why the 80s? And I think I gave you a pretty good answer. Explosive practical effects decade that just technologically right before CGI kind of changed it all. And I think I think filmmakers were maximizing the potential of what they could do with practical effects during that decade, and everyone was seeing the best of the best and following suit. And then you had a wide variety of quality to lack of quality. But you look back at that 30, 40 years now, and it's all appealing.
And it's all in dialogue with each other. You know, one of the things I think that's really fun about your documentaries are, it seems like whether you're, you know, interviewing an actor or an editor or someone who works on special effects side of things, everybody's watching each other's movies. Everybody knows each other's movies. It feels like a community. So it's this interesting, like, it's almost like a dialogue that you're sort of peeking in on. And I think that's why it's sort of a fascinating look into that.
Well, real quick about that, the whole idea is that I really like having a feel of you're sitting at a bar and it's closing time, but you get to stay at the back table with the icons of the industry until 3 in the morning while they just have laughs and tell tales and onset anecdotes and show appreciation to each other's work. And because that's really what it kind of feels like. And that's who they genuinely are. I mean, all these people, once you get them sitting down reminiscing, they're candid and they're honest, and I think their enthusiasm is very genuine, and hopefully that comes through.
Well, I can tell you, I absolutely fell in love with Linnea Quigley. I had, she was somebody that I really didn't know. I realized I've seen a lot of her films, but I didn't realize that, the redheaded girl named Trash from Living Dead is also this one. You didn't like, I never put it together.
Right.
And she's so insightful and funny in the film. I just love her whole attitude of like almost the opposite of the final girl. Like the final girl's like this good girl. Like I played the bad girl. I was the one who got possessed. I was in Night of the Demon, she's introduced by looking at her butt. Like, and she kind of like owned it and loved it. And I was just like, I want to see every film that she's a part of now. I absolutely love listening to this person talk.
It's interesting you compare her story. I mean, there's many women who are very much represented by her stories,
Yeah.
but you take Linnea Quigley and you take Barbara Crampton, for example,
Yeah.
especially talking about, the really memorable scene that she's got in Reanimator. That's an
Yeah.
incredibly vulnerable moment. I mean, I was even a little I wasn't quite sure how to approach talking about that. I kind of talked to her ahead of time about
Right.
talking about that, just to get a sense of her, because I didn't know Barbara before I met her, and I wasn't quite sure if she was totally cool talking about all that stuff, or if that was sort of like a dark chapter. Because the idea is that during that time in the 80s, way before the Me Too movement, a lot of women were exploited and pressured to take off their clothes at the last minute. It was never planned. But they're just like, either they did it and they did it uncomfortably, or they did it because they had no choice. Because everyone says, oh, you have a choice. But no, if you want to make it in Hollywood, there's all sorts of pressures. And unless you're standing there right at that moment, you have no idea what it feels like. So I just think it's very interesting that you compare that story to, say, Barbara Crampton, who at a certain point realized that this is sort of part of the deal if she wanted to work in movies and this genre of movies, that it kind of comes with a territory. And you just have to, grin and bear it. And hopefully you're in a situation where you trust the filmmakers, or at least the environment you're in comparison to Linnea Quigley, who I think also tells a very interesting approach. Her approach was really like, I realized that this was part of the deal, so she owned it. And she's like, I'm gonna make money off of it, and I'm not going to care, because even though I was very shy about my body and taking off my clothes in the very beginning, she's just like, I see what this is about, and if I choose to do this, I will be all over it and master it.
He really did.
And there's just one more element to this. I mean, everyone has their own approach to whether or not this stuff is exploitation or empowerment or embarrassment, whatever you want to approach it as, that's valid, But she made her choices, and the fact that she's confident and stands by her choices, I think, is what comes through and is what is incredibly impressive.
Well, I think your film actually does a really good job in parsing out those conversations, rather than glossing over them or apologizing for them. Something I really appreciate about your films are you do talk about some of that stuff. Like, I really, the segment where in the film about Dress to Kill, which is such a minefield now because we have such a different idea about trans people and sexism and just the controversies at the time compared to how, could you make that film now? How would you? But does that mean we throw it away? I don't think so. I don't think we throw away old things. I think we look at them and go, okay, that's sure different. But
There's a, if I could just interject real quick, there's I don't know if you recall, a couple of years ago, maybe it was more than a couple of years now, Warner Brothers, when they would release their Looney Tunes cartoons on video, they had this wonderful sort of disclaimer at the beginning, And it wasn't like, you know, Warner Brothers doesn't associate with the racist, you know, depictions that are in some of these cartoons. It says these cartoons are a product of their time, you know, and it says some of the, you know, approaches to content are dated and reflect the era that they were made. Yeah. With that in mind, you get to choose if you want to keep watching this or show them to your kids. That's your call. But they're not taking out and editing and censoring all the pieces that in contemporary times, you know, are not quite appropriate or very inappropriate. So I think it's very much the same way. I think looking back at all this stuff, you can't cancel it and you shouldn't cancel it.
No,
you need to educate and understand context. And you can choose however you want to share this or avoid it. But you shouldn't take it away from those who are capable of making their own decisions.
I totally agree. You know, I wish Disney had that mindset. You know, like Song of the South, which, by the way, obviously it's very racist, but it won an Oscar. Zippity-Doo-Dah won an Oscar for Best Song. It also, until quite recently, the attraction Splash Mountain is based on it.
Mm-hmm.
Why not put, I always feel like, put it on Disney Plus, put a disclaimer, say, this is not how we feel now. This is a reflection of its time. But Disney chooses to completely bury things, which to me, they also like cover up, you know, the mermaid's butt in Splash. Disney Plus is a very weird.
Yeah, I won't weigh in on whether it should be on Disney Plus or not. But, you know, Disney very clearly has its reasons from a corporate standpoint in terms of making sure everyone is seen and respected. And if they want to choose what people see based on what they think is the path of least resistance, then that's their choice. You know, I mean, people who really want to see these movies, if they really want to, they could seek them out. They're not that hard to find. You know,
yeah.
I guess on the black market, you can get your copy of Song of the South.
I'm sure you can.
But yeah, I mean, I just think in general, just we have to look back at a certain era, especially when it takes a lot of missteps in as reflected by contemporary evolution of understanding of how things are depicted. And, you know, I think the conversation should be had, and I think people should be educated. I mean, you can have college level courses about why these are good, bad, and ugly. And if people want to enlist in the discussion, by all means. But, you know, if you throw it onto, you know, a format or a platform like, you know, Twitter or anything in between, there's no way to have an intelligent conversation about all this stuff without knee-jerk reactions. And so,
yeah,
tis what it is. You know, if you want to choose a certain platform, that's what you get. If you want to choose a more enlightened arena to have, you know, intellectual conversation about the meaning of all this stuff and why it's good, bad, and ugly, and why why we should or shouldn't have the Confederate flag on the General Lee and reruns of the Dukes of Hazzard, then, you know, there's clearly stories about what led to these,
what
led to these being taken out of circulation. So there you go.
I try and
be diplomatic about all this.
No, I understand. Because, I don't want to pin you down in saying David Warner thinks that Song of the South. No.
Well, just to, you know, put a fine point on it, that is how I think. And that's how I present a lot of these movies, is I don't want to have a very strong opinion because I want people to choose their own, you know, make their own opinions about all this material, all this horror stuff. I mean, just today, I had a little bit of a, you know, I had a laugh to myself because I saw some petition to change Halloween Kills because they kill a bunch of fire, you know, Michael Myers kills a bunch of firefighters, spoiler alert, in the trailer, you know, of Halloween Kills. And so a petition by someone who has a firefighter family said, I want these removed because this is offensive and it sets a bad example. Now, I don't know if this person in the petition also said anyone else being killed, that that's fair game or not.
But,
you know, it's just people are going to, everyone's entitled to the way they feel. But at a certain point, you can't cancel everything.
Yeah. All right. So let me ask you, are you actually making two movies at one time? Are you making Are you making
My le I have a right hand and I have a left hand and I have 2 feet. So yeah.
So where are you in the process of In Search of Tomorrow as opposed to In Search of Darkness 3?
I am taking a break from post-production of In Search of Tomorrow to speak with you right now. Well, we were also in the middle of a campaign for of pre-orders for In Search of Darkness Part 3, you know, all through October until the end of until Halloween at midnight. So my brain is divided in that we've been prepping In Search of Darkness 3, and we're actively prepping to put that together. And we're strategizing it. And right now we're, you know, putting the campaigns running. So you got that. But I've literally am editing actively 24/7 practically, unless I can get some sleep.
Right.
In Search of Tomorrow. So yeah, I'm doing both.
And you're not a man known for short films.
No, no. So yeah, I decided to change it, you know, my tune. And In Search of Tomorrow, I figured the runtime is going to be about 12 minutes or so.
Oh, okay. Sure. Very big departure. But you know, I actually love that. I think it speaks to the genre, right? Because horror fans, we're the people that watch a 6-hour documentary just about the Jason films. You know what I mean? Did you set about saying, I'm going to make this like a mega doc, I'm going to make it 3+, or did you say, I don't care what it's going to be?
The structure is what demanded it. And I'm a slave to the structure. Once Robin Block said, I want to go year by year, movie by movie of the 80s and talk about all our favorite 80s horror films. And I said, that sounds like a great idea. Year by year, movie by movie. There's hundreds of movies.
Right.
There's no way we can get to all of them. So there are certain conceits in the film, like, you know, that wall of posters. The whole idea there was there's more movies in each year than we could even get to.
Right. So you see, I see things and I go, oh, wait, is that going to
Yeah. So that's my way of saying, listen, we see you. We know there are other movies that we're not even talking about. But if we could at least show the poster, that says that there's more to be, you know, discussed and to tackle. But you know, going year by year gets a little tiring in terms of just the way you're sitting and watching that, and there's no way you can get all those movies. And so part of the structure demanded that, because this was going to be like a 2-hour film, maybe 3 hours if we hit our stretch goals from that first, you know, Kickstarter. Yeah. That was the idea, but I realized that there's just no way we can go every year, multiple movies per year. And then if we want larger context chapters in between, right, to just talk about the bigger topics, because you kind of, it becomes a bit of a mishmash if you're right all over the map talking in every single movie. Do you have to cover the theme? Do you have to talk about the behind the scenes? Right. Do you have to talk about the special effects, the music? How was it shelved? What was it supposed to be? You know, and you still haven't talked about craft service yet. You know,
I know.
There's just a way of approaching it where I felt it could be more all encompassing that way. And next thing I know is I've got a 5-hour cut and growing. And we realized that 4.5 hours is sort of the sweet spot for a dual layer Blu-ray disc where you can't have any more information on there. That's the physical cutoff of the time. And so that kind of became it. You know, it's just like you got to make a movie that's 4 hours and 15, 4 hours and 20 plus your credits.
Right.
And you fit in everything that you can. And believe it or not, when you put this together and you have so many films and so many ideas, and you if you interview 50 people, when each interview is no less than an hour, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes even three, depending on who the person is, there's just a wealth of material, and you've got to figure out how can you tell your story. And you still leave, you know, you kill a lot of babies. You make things and you realize they don't fit because you don't have enough of this, that, or the other thing, or it just doesn't fit right. Or you want more of something rather than another, you know, or you just don't have enough material. You just have enough just to sort of give it lip service, but not enough. And maybe that should go in a, you know, a larger context chapter about a topic. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of making and then cutting out to end up with a 4.5-hour film that still isn't enough to cover a decade.
Well, let me ask you about some of those babies you had to kill. Is there anything that you really wanted in either of the films, you loved it. You loved this anecdote. You loved this interview, whatever it was. And you just like, God, it is not fitting the overall.
Yeah. Film. I've had to cut some of my favorite movies and moments and anecdotes just because, despite myself, because I'm just like, it just doesn't fit. As much as I want it in, it just doesn't make sense. You know, the biggest problem is a lot of these people tell these wonderfully spun tales. You know, Larry Cohen would just talk for 10 minutes about some deal at a table in Hollywood and how, you know, the people he was sitting with were a bunch of morons, but he was able to get his movie made. And it's the greatest story in the world. And I'm just sitting there thinking, that's never going to make this movie because that's not what this movie can accommodate. Wow. You know, sitting with Robert Englund for literally 3 hours.
He's so smart. He's so eloquent.
To talk, but he also loves to spin a yarn and set up. He's a very visually descriptive orator.
Yeah.
And you sit there and you think, what a crime. I'm not going to be able to include all these wonderful descriptions about, you know, what the doorway to the apartment where Andy Kaufman lived next to him when he was growing up.
Oh my God.
You know, I mean, I'm like, there's this great Andy Kaufman story he's telling. And I'm like, I sit there thinking, how do I wedge this in? And even if I do, it's still just going to take the air out of this great tale he told me. And that's where it comes down to. I mean, right even now with In Search of Tomorrow right now, I'm just sitting here listening to these interviews that I've conducted saying, these are like master classes and I got to slice and dice to make them fit. And I don't want to sell this improperly that you're not getting a good movie, you know, because I think you've seen In Search of Darkness 1 and 2, you see how it all fits together.
Right.
In terms
right.
of the conversation and the shared love and information that people talk about, you know, yet I'm seeing what you guys aren't seeing. And I'm just saying, gosh, you know, if there's another way we could get this out there, you know, hopefully we'll find it in the future.
Was any of that stuff repurposed for In Search of Darkness 2, or did you just start fresh with all new interviews and stuff?
In Search of Darkness 2 is a COVID era movie. When we were making In Search of Darkness 2, COVID was like, boom. So we wanted to make a lot more people than we were able to get. And that was literally because of, we were smack dab in the middle of COVID. And a lot of people were like, you know, we shoot in person. We don't do Zoom calls for our movie. It's 4K. So, you know, there are a lot of people who we had lined up and they said, you know, we'd love to do this, but I can't be there in person. And I understood that because I didn't want to be there in person with them either. Right. The last thing you want to do is you don't want to like kill all these people are like in their 60s and their 70s or even older. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is be responsible for like killing a horror icon literally by breathing on them. So there's a good portion of material that never made the cut of In Search of Darkness 1 that I wanted to be able to use in some way because there's just so much gold there that wasn't like, oh, it's on the cutting room floor because it's not good. No, it's literally like if you have 75, 100 hours of footage and you have to cut that down to 4.5 hours, you're going to have a lot of great material that you just can't craft in that 4.5 hour without doing a whole other 4.5 hour movie or more, you know, a whole series. So a good portion of that went into In Search of Darkness 2 with the idea that this is now a series. And if you play it all together back to back, it's one coherent, you know, discussion. I mean, we redid a bunch of, you know, we did some new shoots with like Kane Hodder and Bill Moseley and Cassandra Peterson and some other folks. But the idea was to get a bunch of new faces. We did 23 interviews. I got 15 new faces. And this is all in the time of COVID.
Wow. From In Search of Darkness 1 to In Search of Darkness 2, Search of Darkness 2 opens us up to foreign films as well as more like titles that you don't necessarily haven't heard of as much. Mm-hmm. I know you're at the early days of 3, and I know part of the campaign is backers can help choose the films, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, is there anything that you want to do with 3 that would be something new that you haven't done with the other two?
Yeah, I might have a thing or two up my sleeve, but the idea, I think, is what you talked about. We genuinely have recognized that there would be no 3 if we didn't have a bunch of people saying, can't wait for 3, or I could watch these all day. I mean, I genuinely thought after In Search of Darkness Part Two, that would be it. And maybe we'd be going to other decades and other genres and stuff like that. But the demand really was so great for a part three that I was like, oh, I guess I'm making a part three then. You know, I want to do it, but I didn't know I was, people wanted it.
Right.
And so the idea really is, because there's so many films that we still haven't even touched on. You know, the concept is, it's really like the underbelly of horror, of, you know, the dusty boxes at the bottom shelf of your mom and pop VHS shop, if not the triple bootlegged copies of Faces of Death that your cousin left in your locker. You have to hide in your knapsack from your parents. But, you know, the idea is there's still theatrical films that still haven't been, you know, covered. There's still all this great straight video stuff. There's all this great shot on video stuff. There's all this great international material. There's just, it just can go on and on and on and on and on. And right. The idea that we, if you back the film, you get the opportunity yourself as a backer to vote on what you want. And it could be any title whatsoever, or even the chapters in between. You get to choose these things, and you know, by the meritocracy of wanting all this stuff badly enough, that's really going to tell us. That's going to tell me what a lion's share of the material is going to be. And I think that's super cool, because that's what I want. I want to make a movie that everyone who is, if you've been on the ride for part one and part two, and you still want to be on the ride for part three, you should get as much of what you want as possible. Now, of course, everyone can't get everything that they want, because there's right. lots of people and there's lots of opinions. We all know that. But literally, this is like, I can't wait for the list that I get after we do the voting process. You know, people could suggest things, they could vote on things. And at the end of the day, I'm going to get a tidy list saying, cool, everyone wants this. I can't wait to dive into it.
That's so awesome. I mean, you can tell watching the film that like you're the real deal, right? It's a fan thing. It's a conversation by fans for fans. And that's why I think that's just one of the cool things about the way we can make stuff now, which is the crowdsourcing way of like literally everyone can be involved. Like, what do you want to talk about? What do you want to hear about?
It's pretty cool. I mean, I think we live in a magical age where, because of technology, because I can talk to you on Zoom, you know, because people can sort of interact on social media and platforms. And I think having access to a group of fans who are also making films, who are not part of the Hollywood machine, you know, being able to sort of peel the curtain back and see how we do things, right or wrong, it's super cool, you know. And that's kind of part of the process here, is that we're not like, you give us money and we give you a movie and some posters at the end of the day. Well, that's right. pretty cool too.
Right.
We really welcome the back and forth and the discourse and the opinions and the passion that everyone in this community is giving us as part of this process of making another movie that essentially is yours at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. I gotta say, I really do love your films, and I've watched them multiple times. I'm at the point where, like, you know, I'll watch 20 minutes here and 20 minutes there, and I've kind of in my mind melded one and two together.
Sure.
Well,
they're very similar.
Yes, but it is that sort of fun, like, it's almost like, I don't know, it's like a nice warm blanket. It's like, yeah. It's like, this is, I'm a nerd, and this is like the nerdy stuff inside my head.
Someone said, posted just the other day on social media, which I really enjoyed, was, I can't wait till part three comes out so I can watch all three back to back with pizza and wings, you know?
Perfect.
And I'm just like, that's exactly it. You know, how cool is it going to be when this third movie comes out and you can just spend a day watching 13 hours of 80s horror? And you could stop and start whenever you want, and you can introduce your friends, and you could hit pause every time you want, and, you know, watch some of these movies that you're like, holy shit, I didn't even know about this film. And you know, part of this is like I said, you know, when you're a cynical teen, or, you know, you look back at these and you look at it from a different lens of an era many years on now. I have a greater respect for a lot of these franchises and iconic villains and characters that back in the day I saw it more of as a cynical cash grab, but they've endured you know, the likes of a Pinhead or a Freddy or a Chucky, whoever they may be, because it all started for me with Michael Myers, you know, so everyone else was like, you know, second tier.
Right.
Don't be offended, everybody. I love all these guys. I love Leatherface. I love all, you know, I love all these offshoots. But the thing is, to me, I viewed it from a different lens, but I look back at it now, especially because they endure. It gave me an opportunity when I'm like, all right, well, let's give Halloween 5 another look. Now I can fully understand and appreciate Halloween 3 because I knew what it was meant to be, you know, and why it fits but doesn't fit, you know, as it's sort of this anthology offshoot. It's interesting to look at that kind of stuff in retrospect.
I mean, I can tell you as a viewer the exact same thing. As much as I think I know, there's tons of titles in your films that I'm like, I either really never heard of or completely dismissed. I always said, oh, Prom Night 2, that's not even a real sequel, right? The first one's a slasher. The second one's, I literally never even thought of it. And then when I saw the segment in Search of Darkness 2 about Prom Night 2, I went and sought it out. And It's incredible. I mean,
yeah, Mary Lou. It's like an entire, it's like a reinvention. If you think about it, some of these, for better or for worse, some of these sequels are in name only. And the only way they got to make these is if it's almost like Troll and Troll 2.
Right.
You know, it's like they're like, well, we could get the name to get people to pick up the box or buy it or rent it, but we got to do something entirely different. And if you look at it rather than, oh, this is nothing like the first one, and you say, oh, they had to make something entirely different, so they did. You know, it's kind of interesting to sort of see where that went and if it was successful or not.
Yeah. And I love the idea of young female viewers being emboldened by Mary Lou. Like, what a cool, I mean, as a, you know, I'm a cisgendered straight white dude. And, you know, those are the eyes I have. So that's how I see the world. So it never even occurred to me, like, how cool that experience would be. And that's another thing I like about your films, which is you do have a lot of different contemporary people talking about, you know, the looking back.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yeah, like Phil Noble Jr. or Heather Wixon, for example. Yeah. I think their insight is absolutely crucial to sort of put some perspective on these things.
Oh,
you know, in with Hello Mary Lou, to have, you know, Phil talking about back then, you know, she was a slut. Now she owns her sexuality.
Right.
And to have someone like Darcy the Mail Girl, a.k.a. Diana Prince, saying she was my hero because of these aspects to her personality. You know, having them talk about that and share about it, where, you know, if you talked about this movie when it first came out, it would be a very different conversation. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I know we got to wrap up soon. I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on contemporary horror movies? Because when you look at In Search of Darkness, a lot of these are like middle budget movies.
Mm-hmm.
But now it seems you either have a micro, not at all budget, or gigantic Marvel Star Wars budget. And I'm wondering, like, how do you see the genre going?
I think a lot of people are saying, and I agree, that we're in a bit of a horror renaissance. I think horror has always been this sort of stalwart genre where, even if it was dismissed by, you know, the Motion Picture Academy, or as, you know, Tom Holland says, you know, it's the redheaded stepchild of Hollywood.
Right.
You know, it's still always been a very reliable way of making a very cheap money movie and then getting a pretty handsome return on your investment, just based on sort of exploitation elements. But that's always been the case. And that also, you know, and in contemporary times when you can make like Conjuring movies and have Warner Brothers put them out, you know, or A24, and you've got Hereditary and
right.
Midsommar. You know, I mean, I just saw Malignant, you know, when that just came out. I'm loving this stuff. I mean, I just think it's great. I think with all these streaming services, you have all these outlets. You know, there's this weird, with all these streaming services, you have all these outlets for more horror, and it's great. And some of it's great and some of it's not great. And it's always been that way and it always will be.
Right.
I think there's more of a tolerance now to distribute and to advertise and to bring horror movies to the masses, because they still are doing very well. You know, again, it doesn't take much to make them. You know, there's a whole other story here that we don't get into, but it's like, you know, the way Hollywood is working now, you're either working on a 3 million or less budget, you know, or a 300,000 budget, or you're 100 million and above. You know, a lot of these sort of mid-range movies that were any you know, currently now are anywhere between, you know, 25 million to, you know, 60 million to make. No one wants to bet on that. It's very strange. So you're either at the, you know, mega high level of, you know, marketing and advertising and worldwide distribution, or you have like a little movie that could, that's hoping to get some Amazon Prime or, you know, Shudder exposure. Either way, as fans, we win big time. You know,
right.
I mean, I'm watching Midnight Mass right now. I'm a little behind the curve on that one, but I've had no time. But I, you know, I'm watching it now, and I'm about halfway through, and I'm really, really enjoying it. And all I can think of is like, this is a quality film, you know, by the guy who did Dr. Sleep, which also really failed at the box office because right. I think it was a great movie, but they didn't know how to market it. Quite, you know, if you look at the marketing on Dr. Sleep, yes, it's the title that Stephen King gave his book as the sequel to The Shining. But to the average person who knows The Shining, I don't think they necessarily know
right.
it's what Dr. Sleep is. And if they called it maybe like Overlook,
right, you know? Right.
And they showed the Overlook Hotel and they showed, you know, Ewan McGregor, I think they probably would have gotten more mileage of it. That. And if they had put it in out in October instead of November,
yeah, you know, how about that?
That is a weird misstep as well. But I know there are all sorts of decisions behind these things that make sense to the studio at the time. But we just see what went, you know, what succeeded and what failed. But I digress. But I bring that up because the name is escaping me now. But the guy who did the guy who did Dr. Sleep and is doing, you know, Midnight.
Oh,
Mass.
Mike Flanagan.
Mike Flanagan. Yeah, Mike Flanagan. I mean, all power to him that he could get eight episodes to be able to take the time to tell a really well crafted, character driven tale with all these wonderful elements of horror and, you know, theology and religion and philosophy and scare the crap out of us too. And
yeah,
you know, like I'm a kid in the candy store.
Yeah. All right. I have one last question and this might be hard. Okay. Recently we did an episode on this podcast of our favorite jump scares. My number one was from The Exorcist Part 3.
Uh-huh.
The decapitation.
Well, you took mine. That's what came to my head. Keep going though.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask you, would that be yours too?
I was in a movie theater when I saw that, and I remember that's what won me over there. I was already enjoying it, but the movie was kind of a slow burn. And
so
I remember that one particular scene, because it takes so long to build itself up, you could hear in the theater, people were getting a little agitated and chit-chatty because they're like, what's the deal? Why is this? How long do we have to watch
this long
hallway shot of a hospital? Why is this important?
No popcorn. Yeah.
And then, you know, the screech. Ooh. And there's the carrot. Oh my gosh. Don't
so
spoil
good.
It, I guess, for people who don't know it. But I will always, there are these theatrical memories. It's all about the community watch. For some of the greatest movies I've ever seen, where people were still laughing and giggling and frightened for 5 solid minutes after that scene happened. And it was the ultimate jump scare. I'm very particular with my jump scares because I am angrily against the fake jump scare, you know, just to keep things interesting or make sure you don't fall asleep, you know?
You mean like the cat? Or
the cat trope.
Yeah.
So listen, you get one. You can have one. And if you can get me for one, good. All kudos for you. I'm not going to get angry. Like, okay, oh, you got me. That's the genuine jump scare. But if you're going to, you know, if you're going to pepper those throughout a movie, you lose my respect. That's all I could say.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it goes back to, we'll go back to American Werewolf when, you know, David Naughton looks at himself, you know, he's at Alex's flat and he looks at himself in the mirror and he pushes the mirror back and there's, you know, there's Jack all,
right,
you know, decomposed. I'm still like, my heart's still racing from that.
Wow,
from
yeah.
Years ago.
So, and then it becomes a comedy scene, which is so brilliant. That's such a brilliant movie. Thank you so much for being here, David Weiner. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. 80shorrordoc.com is where you can go and become a part of In Search of Darkness 3.
Yep.
We end every episode by quoting Gonzo from the classic television program Muppet Babies. He says, go bye-bye. Could you say go bye-bye for us?
Well, I'll say go bye-bye after I say go see the Muppets Haunted Mansion on Disney Plus, because we're talking about Disney Plus. I watched it just this weekend, and it was so fun. It was so well done, and, and it was 10 times better than the Haunted Mansion movie that starred Eddie Murphy.
I'm obsessed with the Haunted Mansion.
I love, you know, and no shade to haunt, to Eddie Murphy, by the way. I just, oh, look at that right behind you.
Yeah,
the wallpaper has a blanket. Yeah, I no shade to Eddie Murphy. I love Eddie Murphy, but I just thought that movie around him was, it was just oil and water, didn't fit his personality, and it was just, it was awful. Even though there were a couple Easter eggs in there, so I got a smile ear to ear watching the Muppet Haunted Mansion special. It was very fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, David, go bye bye, and thanks for having me on.
Bye bye. Thank you so much. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.